This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
I've lived through three supposed end of days. It's all horseshit.
Welcome, everybody, to Season 5 of Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. We are back from our Christmas and New Year's breaks, and kicking off Season 5 by looking at Season 2 of The Witcher, the Netflix adaptation of Andrzej Sapkowski's novels. We'll go over some news first. We've got a bit of a long news section this week to plug into. We'll tell you a bit about this season of The Witcher, our thoughts, and then we'll get stuck into some of the monsters that the show brings up, including a little bit in genetic diversity. And then Libby will look at Slavic folklore. As always, the show will be broke up into those different segments, so if you don't feel like hearing about Sam's Christmas shenanigans, you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. Before we get stuck into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsik, a disease ecologist at the Gent-Burien University of the Vegev. Alongside Adam is... All right, hang on, I've been working on this, but it hasn't been very good so far, so...
The Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup.
Nah, it's not.
It sounds like Keanu Reeves trying to do an English accent.
It's like Keanu Reeves doing Henry Cavill.
I know where the bastard sleeps.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Yeah. And last but not least, we are joined by Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist. Oh, how was everybody's Christmas and New Year's?
Full of video games.
Yeah.
Adam and Libby, you're in a country where they don't celebrate Christmas as a, you know, traditional sort of thing.
Or New Year's. What'd you get up really?
To? Really?
Nope. They do the Jewish New Year, which is back in September. Yeah.
Well, we had a very white Christmas over here. I'm assuming you did as well, Dave.
Yeah.
We are in Norway.
Well, I am in Norway, yeah, and Dave's in Canada, so white Christmas is kind of the norm now. So my Christmas story, which is kind of... Well, partly fueled by alcohol, but not that much, okay? I can't blame that much of it on being slightly tipsy. Our kid told us earlier this year that he doesn't really think Santa Claus exists anymore. And, you know, it's kind of a bit sad because the magic goes, but we didn't want to be lying to him to keep this, to keep the myth up. We didn't want to have to lie to him about things. So we wanted to let him down easy. So I was going to be Santa this year. And then, you know, I was going to take the beard off and say, sorry, Eric, you were right. But yeah, you know, let him down easy. So I made my excuses. I pretended I was feeling sick. And I went to bed early, and then I got into the room where I had the Santa costume, and I put the Santa costume on, and I asked for Cammy to bring me some glasses, right, to, you know, hide my face completely. Now, these weren't like store glasses that you wear in a costume. These were her father's glasses, and I couldn't see a fucking thing through them. Right, add to that, I've got this massive bushy beard on, a great big bushy beard, and a massive wig, because headline, I can't grow a beard, and even if I did, it would have been blonde, not white. And so everything's just falling apart straight away. I can't keep the cushion underneath the Santa suit. So it's just constantly falling out. So I'm like, don't worry. When you get to the back door, it'll be fine. I went out the window, not around the front of the house, because I thought, you know, oh, then I'll have to put shoes on. And I only have my shoes. And despite the fact that Santa's going to be 6'5" this year with a broken Australian Norwegian accent, the shoes is what will tip my kid off that it's me, you know? So I've hopped out the window. It was a lot further down from the window than I thought it was, first of all. So I had to put the present back inside and then put all my effort into getting out the window, right? Got there, was holding onto the window ledge, grabbed the present from inside, took one step, the whole floor was frozen over, so I've gone straight onto my ass, right? Very fragile present, so I'm like, fuck, I've probably broken this Christmas present. This is going to be a bad Christmas. But picked the present up, went round the side, trying to be as quiet as possible so he wouldn't see me coming. And as soon as I get round the side of the house, right, he's already opened the door, so he's heard me. And I'm like, I don't have any time to, like, you know, adjust to make everything look a bit more realistic. So I've just had to walk up, like, barely holding the pillow under my stomach, being like, in Norwegian, I hear there's been, you know, I hear there's a little boy this year who's behaved very well. And then my kid's going along with it, you know, he wants the magic to continue. But then as soon as I get into the house, because my whole face is covered with like the beard and the hair, the dog freaks out, like immediately loses her shit. So Cammy's trying to hold the dog back and I've leant down to give Eric their Christmas present. Dog charges past, grabs the beard and rips it off. Like just like not having this shit at all. So yeah, at that point I've taken the glasses off as well and like you know, said to Eric, Merry Christmas, sorry about this, you're right, you know. And he gave me a death stare, but he was like, I've known since I was six, Dad. And I was like, oh okay, well it was nice of you to keep sure. going. Dog's still not calming down though. Dog is freaking out. So I've taken like off the hair and I've taken off the hat and the dog is still like, fuck, what's going on here? What is going on here? Who is this strange man? Why does he now look like Sam? I don't like this. I don't like this at all. This is the worst Christmas ever. So we finally got to calm down, but it took a long time. And that is my Christmas story.
That's amazing.
That's fantastic.
Santa!
Yeah?
You're bringing my present early?
Yeah.
So, disclaimer before I start this new section, I don't like shitting on people, especially when it's a member of the general public who is, you know, trying to contribute to biological debate and asking genuinely good questions. So I don't mean to crap on anybody here, but that is not what's happening in this story. So I feel a little more justified in making fun of these people.
Okay, let's let the pile on begin.
Mm-hmm. So every now and then, there are some non-biologists who weigh in on biological themes with some interesting views. This happens about once a year. Somebody will come up with this sort of idea. I'll read out the initial tweet which sparked controversy to you all. All sentient beings deserve a life free from the constant threat and fear of predation. Doesn't matter which species the predator belongs to. Predation abolition is the inevitable conclusion of total liberation. Now, obviously this triggered a bit of a what are you talking about pile on. And the person who wrote this dubbed anybody freaking out a bioconservative. So the tweet goes, bioconservatives are seething at this, love it. Point is to modify ecology into not needing predation between sentient beings in the first place. Moving forward with some more tweets related to this, somebody asked, like, how would this happen? What would this look like? And one of the responses was, imagine a Boston Dynamics skeleton encased in lab-grown meat controlled by AI. You stop lions eating real antelope, but let them eat these synthetic antelope. What? After the lions and scavengers are done, the carcasses, robots, reanimate and walk to the warehouse to get re-meated.
Where's this meat come from?
Synthetic lab-grown meat controlled by AI. So,
of course. Yeah.
I just like the term re-meated.
Yes!
Predators chew on bones. So
yeah, look, I don't. I think there's viscera. A lot of things that haven't been thought through here. Okay. What else?
So wait, Sam, you're saying that this idiot talking about things they know nothing about has some holes in their logic?
A few, you know. Huh. Here's another one. I feel like, so in response to this last one, the Boston Dynamics lab meat grown skeleton gazelles, I feel like this is technically still predation. We must morally improve nature. We will only have true liberation when lions no longer desire prey. And then last one I'll read out is, we don't want to abolish predation because predation is inherently bad. God, no, why would we do that? We want to abolish predation because it often causes unpleasant experiences for the prey, and an unpleasant experience is inherently bad. Eating non-sentient objects, either potatoes or robo-gazelle, is fine.
What if this tweet is giving me an unpleasant experience?
Yeah.
Is that morally wrong?
I think that is inherently bad.
Is this a joke?
No, it's not a joke. This crops up all the time. There was a paper last year written by a philosopher from the University of New South Wales called Ben Bramble, called Painlessly Killing Predators, which suggested we either painlessly put down all predators or genetically modify them so that they become herbivores. What the
fuck? These people are fucking idiots. There's no other way to put that. Yeah. They're fucking stupid.
It's just... Oh, In fairness, the Ben Bramble thing, he said it was supposed to be a thought experiment. But if you're doing an ecological thought experiment, get an ecologist on board.
Yeah.
If you want to read more about that one, by the way, you can go onto ecologyforthemasses.com. I wrote a piece on it at the time. The piece is called An Attempt to Understand Painlessly Killing Predators. Spoiler alert, it was a failed attempt. And last bit of news, sad news as opposed to the hilarity we've seen, although I think she would probably want it, you know, a fair bit of hilarity around this, is that Betty White passed away this week.
Yeah.
New Year's Day? New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve, yeah.
Yeah, on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, and look, we just wanted to give her a quick shout out because of her amazing role in Lake Placid that we touched on for Livy's first ever episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, adding on to our in memoriam session, over the Christmas holidays, we also lost E.O. Wilson, an incredible scientist and one of the most prominent features in biological science of the last century.
Called the New Age Darwin, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Kicked off a lot of species modeling, distribution modeling, that sort of stuff. Island biogeography theory. Which we talked about extensively whenever we look at King Kong, all comes from him. And he's made improvements on it since. He was a huge part of that movement. He was, yeah, inspirational a lot.
If I had a dick, this is where I'd tell you to suck it.
Summary this week. The Witcher Written Works are a series of 6 fantasy novels and 15 short stories written by Polish author Andrzej Sikorski. In which he describes how different female characters' breasts appear visually to the reader. The Witcher video games are incredibly well-received, award-winning video game trilogy in which players can see cutting-edge graphics displayed through haunting landscapes, grim monsters, and different females' characters' breasts and buttocks. The Witcher TV show is an ongoing show in which you can see live-action representation of all those different females' characters' breasts. Listen, if I have to sit through this men writing women bullshit, then y'all are stuck with this female writing summaries.
It's fine. Is that the summary?
Oh yeah, that's the summary.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
I was trying to explain to my partner there's a new Witcher board game coming out, but it doesn't have any female characters you can play as because women can't be witchers. And she went, "I am tired of this bullshit."
I said at one point, does Yennefer look different this season? And then Cam was just like, I think it's just, you know, she's got clothes on. with what we liked, I like the main characters. I like the main three. I like Ciri. I think Yennefer in particular was much improved from last season. Having said that, kind of a low bar. And look, Henry Cavill still looks like he's having a fun time.
It's great.
And I preferred last season, I think, because it was more Monster of the Week, but he's still... I feel he's still dragging this into positive territory just because he's having such a good time. And Vesemir, it was also good to see Kim Bodnia from, people might know him from The Bridge. As Vesemir, I thought he looked like he was having a great time as well. I really enjoyed him. So yeah, I like some of the characters I really enjoyed.
I think, like Sam said, Henry Cavill is just having a great time with this. As we all know, Henry Cavill is a huge nerd. He loves these games. He really, really likes playing Geralt, and it really shows with his on-screen portrayal. I think he's done a great job of capturing the essence of that character, even if he looks nothing like the willowing Geralt is supposed to look like. But who cares, because he's doing a great job. I really enjoyed Christopher Pivu as Novella. That was great. And that's what I like.
I loved they got a better budget this year for, like, they stepped up a lot of, like, their CGI and their animated characters, and seeing these, it just looked a lot cleaner in a lot of areas, and they got to do a lot bigger set pieces, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump on board the Henry Cavill fan train. I mean...
And jump on board the Henry Cavill, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Let him run a train on me. So...
If there's one man who could do it, it'd be him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, to me, he steals the show. I think a lot of the other actors do great, but it's really hard to beat him. And I hope I'm not stepping on any trivia toes with this, but one thing I read when I was looking up trivia for this week is that and this goes back to the first season when we first started playing Geralt and he was cast, they actually wrote more lines for him, like script lines. And they said he did such a good job with, like, just facial and, like, emoting and, like, sound effects with, like, grunts and, like, looks and body language, that they felt like he captured a better Geralt than they had actually written. So they cut a bunch of lines and made him more simplified.
The scripts were just like constant lines and then him saying fuck at the end instead.
Exactly. I think that just goes to show like how well he has captured the character and displays that on camera.
Yeah. Okay, so what we didn't like. We talked last year about Dune being very decipherable to people who haven't read the books. This was hard to follow. I had no idea what was going on with all these political machinations, and I say that as somebody who has read the first book in the series, which a lot of this was drawn from. I had no idea what the hell was going on. I have no idea how one would follow this. I still have no idea who the fuck Redania is at the end of the series, or where the fuck that is, or who represents it. It was slow in places, which I really didn't expect from this. Why are people saying witches when there are witchers in this universe? That was really confusing all the time. This should be better. This should be so much fun, and it's just not. And it makes me angry.
As someone who has read all of the books, I will support Sam's notion of not being able to follow what is going on in this show, because what the fuck are they doing with this show? To me, I've been thinking about this a lot in the last 2 days, because every time we watch this show, I get angrier and angrier at what they've done with these characters. And I realize the books aren't perfect, but it's a world that I really appreciate. And the game is, The Witcher 3 in particular, has helped me appreciate the world so much more. And seeing what the show has done with these characters, outside of Henry Cavill being an amazing Geralt, is like, if Michael Bay took Harry Potter, for those of you that still like Harry Potter, written by the notorious TERF, J.K. Rowling, it was like, okay, but every time they use a wand, an explosion happens, and a car comes flying out of it. And inside of the car, there's a woman with big tits, and she's not wearing a shirt. Because I'm Michael Bay, and that sounds fun. This would make it better. That's what I feel like they've done with every single one of these dumb changes to the show that makes no fucking sense to me. And it's really disappointing. It makes it really hard to watch. And if it wasn't for Henry Cavill, I would have stopped watching the show. Not a lot of monsters either, which is a bummer for the season.
So my two biggest concerns were, one, there was just not enough use of fucks in this season. It was my favorite part of the first Witcher.
Absolutely. I fully back that.
There are these like great scenes where like Cavill discovers like he's gone to like all this trouble to get to like a witch's hut or something like that, and then finds, you know, it's empty or it hasn't worked out or the monster's not there. And like I'd be on the edge of my seat waiting, and then it would like cut to credits or move on, and I'd be like, no! No! Two, and we'll get into this because this is what made this episode so hard. There are just not enough monsters. The first season was jam-packed. He is a monster hunter.
This is literal trade.
I sat down this week to try and pull together all the monsters from the season, and I went through my list, and I'm like, really? I'm like, I don't even count some of these as monsters, but like, okay, fine.
Yeah. And that was so... Because the first season, Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, is mainly pulled from The Last Wish and Sword of Destiny, which are two collections of short stories about what happens before the main events kick off. And so they can just do kind of like story of the week, monster of the week sort of stuff. Whereas we shift into this season and it's just like... It's trying to be one smooth narrative along with doing Monster of the Week at the same time. And I thought it really didn't work.
Yeah, and the times when they do those, they're either making up a monster for the purpose of the show, or they're pulling like the very first episode with Novella. That is one of the short stories from the short story collections. It was not part of this main narrative. So it makes it really hard plot-wise to follow that.
Mm. Yeah.
Mine are definitely... just classic Hollywood bullshit. Number one, I think the age difference between Henry Cavill and Anya Chalotra. Yeah. You know, I'm pretty sure when they're filming this. Yeah, Yennefer. I think he is 38 and she's 25. I just don't like it. I think Hollywood can do better. And then also... I think I brought this up in a previous episode. The amount of mascara that they put on Ciri is so distracting to me, because you have this modern element in a middle age setting, and you see Geralt, who looks rough and tumble. You see, you know, and I get for the sorceresses, that makes sense, you know, because they're always supposed to be like done up and well done. But she's, you know, doing her training and fighting, and it's just like she looks like she has extensions on, and it bothers me, and I can't say it enough. Just stop fucking doing that and treat women like they're normal and characters in whatever fucking movie that they're supposed to be in. So if they're in space, don't fucking put mascara on them. If they're in the Middle Ages, don't fucking put mascara on them. People will still like them, I promise.
What's worse, this or Michelle Pfeiffer being stuck in the quantum realm for 15 years and still having makeup?
I think this is worse because she's also a child.
Do you, on the age gap thing, do you think it's somewhat better because both characters are supposed to be like
ageless,
300 years old?
They're in their hundreds, like 90 to 100 years old.
Okay.
I mean, I think narratively, yeah, but like if that's narrative, then she can be whatever fucking age, you know, like they both can.
With one thing I actually wanted to add in for Dave's point is that there are very few fucks, but there are some very good fucks in this one. Like when Ciri's trying to get them across the river and she just screams out fuck and they appear on the other side of the river, like she's teleported them using the power of fuck. I thought that was fantastic.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Don't you mean the chaos? Because they can't say magic? Because why would you say magic?
Fuck, do they not say magic?
No, they do say magic, but they also say chaos, which makes you think it's two different things. I was going to say, speaking of more female sexist bullshit, so for trivia this week, Sikowski chose, I'm probably going to say this wrong, so apologies, Weidzman, it's the Polish word, as the male equivalent for witch, which is Weidzma. And he noted that the word witcher is the natural male version of the English word witch. And so at this time, I'd also like to submit the word bitcher to be colloquially used.
While we're on this subject of unfortunate portrayals of different groups, I want to point out something which, again, I'm not... Apologies if I'm being insensitive when I say this, but there are two actresses in the series who had their skin tone significantly lightened for the series itself. One of them is, and most people will have noticed this, Anna Schaffer, who plays Triss Merigold. People will notice that she looks significantly different this season. She's got redder hair, and it almost looks like she's got lighter skin color, although, as we were saying before the show, that might just be because the hair color makes it look that way. But the other actress who this has happened to is Messia Simpson, who plays Francesca, the elven sorceress, whose skin is significantly lighter in this series than it is in real life. And she's also been given red hair. There are, people of color playing tons of different roles in this. So I'm not quite sure why they did this. But there has been some controversy raised online at this change that they've put on these actresses playing these roles.
And on that note, just a quick shout out to some Twitter users who pointed this out and were the reasons I found out that Messia Simpson was actually black in the first place. So first of all, to Clarkeisha at I Write All Day, who basically posted the two photos side by side attached to the hashtag The Kent Test. The Kent Test being the women of color version of the Bechdel test, in essence. And one of the best responses to that was by Becca O'Neill, who said, because they can't have us seeing two black women plotting some magical shit, I guess. And one last comment, which was by Franz Louvre on Twitter. This was in French, and I'm translating probably badly here, which said, in reference to the first season at least, Yennefer was less pale, Triss had not been ironed with a curler, and Messia Simpson has been cleared or lightened to death. Which is fair enough.
One thing there's been a big issue with, and I think Libby can probably speak about this a lot more in depth than I can, is the issue of inclusion in fantasy literature, especially people that are just white, especially white males. And casting the actor for Triss as a person of color was wonderful. My only issue with it was they didn't make her hair red in the first season. And that's one of those things where you can make changes to a story where there's no reason not to have more people of color in the show or in this universe. It fits. There's elves of color, there's white elves, there's people of color, there's white people in the show, which is wonderful. But this show's like, you know what? Let's just change this huge aspect of Triss's character, this fact that she's a redhead. Let's just, fuck it, we don't need that. Let's change it. But in the second season, we're going to change it back, but also lighten her skin. What the fuck is going on?
So, another bit of trivia is that Henry Cavill performed all of his own stunts. So he devoted all of his off-camera time to practicing sword fighting. He, like, held it constantly, walked around with it, practiced it.
old Viggo Mortensen route.
Yeah, did not use a stunt double at all, which I found really cool. I always appreciate when actors do that.
And badly hurt himself doing the movie, or doing this series, ended up
he did, tore his calf muscle.
Yep. And
yeah, I always worry about that because of like the Brendan Fraser stories.
Yeah, and actually, as much as we celebrate this, my partner's brother like works in the film industry, and the thing they bitch about all the time is actors doing their own stunts, because if they get themselves hurt, then the entire production is set back, and everybody basically has to wait as this person recovers. And two, it takes away a job from a stuntman. Like, stuntmen are trained to do this. This is what their work is. This is what they're supposed to engage in. So it just, it really does not end up coming off as favorably as the audience. It's like, oh, it's so cool they did their own stunts. And anyone who's working on the film is like, fuck.
Yeah, but I feel like it really does help a lot of the time when you can see that it's Henry Cavill doing shit. Like, they're not cutting away and doing, you know, a bird's eye view of a fight or, you know, a long shot. I think that really helps.
I think to me, to play, like, Switzerland here, I just said I like it too, and I agree with Sam to that point. Like, that's why I like it, is it adds, it's more realistic. I think when you start getting into Tom Cruise level of stunts, where you're doing something more than just riding a horse, or, you know, doing a little sword fight, but jumping off tall structures, you know, riding on moving trains, that I think I would start to be more in Dave's camp of, like, you need to do a trained professional there.
Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you.
So my last bit of trivia is in the episode where we see the medallion tree in Kaer Morhen. It has the medallions of all the fallen witchers hanging from it. And if you catch it, they have an Easter egg. And one of the medallions is the one Geralt wears in the Witcher 3 video game. So it's like a 3D wolf's head. So you can see it in that episode.
Hell yeah,
cool.
Before we get stuck into the science this week, if you've got any thoughts or questions, as always, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I am at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And if you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about the less movie/TV related ecology that Adam, myself, and a massive team of writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. Before we actually get into looking at the different monsters separately this week, I just wanted to touch on something which is kind of alluded to throughout the whole series, which is that the monsters coming through this season are quite different from what the witches previously have had to deal with. The Leshy, for instance, Kim Bodnia cannot figure out why it's acted or has possessed the witcher who gets killed in a certain way.
Eskel.
Eskel, yeah. There is a line spoken in one of the later episodes saying, "What the fuck kind of basilisks are those?" By one of the witches. And there's a couple of other things as well that are thought to have not been seen before. Like Geralt at one point with a myriapod says, "What?" A lot of people are like, just essentially say, "What the fuck is that?" So, the conjunction of the rounds happened 1500 years before this, right, Adam?
Something like that.
Yeah, and it was kind of what's seen as like this big one-off migration event where a bunch of things, a bunch of these creatures went from different orbs into the other orbs and then landed on the middle orb, which included the humans coming in as well, right? That's when humans arrived on the continent.
Yes.
I believe so.
Yeah. The elves were there, but the humans were not.
And so what you have, and we talked about this a lot last time, is a bunch of new species coming over into a new continent and setting up as invasives. And what I said last time a lot of the time was that these are going to be very small gene pools, right? So you're going to have what Adam talks about all the time, a bottleneck event, where only a small part of the population survives, or in this case, moves over into an area. And you have a very limited representation of the larger gene pool that you had back on the mainland, or in this case, the other ball.
Which gives you the founder effect.
Yeah. So we said that last time, a lot of these species, we don't think they last that long because of that limited gene pool. You would have excess inbreeding and the genetic health would decline quite rapidly. If the initial event, the conjunction of the balls, only brought in a few different ones from time to time. But, so, how does that translate to here? What I'm trying to say is that whenever you see these different creatures and the witches are saying, that's not this, that's different, why is it different? I think it's just because you had a very limited gene pool that came across last time. And you've now got species which have probably not evolved that much because it's only been 1500 years, but may have gone through some physiological changes back on their home planet. And are just maybe a different, represent a different part of the gene pool or a different morph that's come through this time. So they're saying, oh, that looks really different, or it isn't really different, but it's probably the exact same species and they're just used to it looking in a very specific way.
Yeah, and that's where the founder effect comes in, because if you have that limited representation of a group of organisms and they then proliferate, any like suite of characteristics or behaviors you have with those organisms are most likely going to be what any of the subsequent population is going to have, thus the effect of the founder organisms.
Yeah, and so you're getting non-founder organisms coming into this particular shuttlecock, and everybody's like, what the hell is this? And it's a different member of the same species that you just haven't seen before because it's not related to the things that are on your round. I think that's all we're looking at here.
Yeah,
I feel that.
Yeah. And this is a really good way for those species to now survive, because if you have more constant migration events that are bringing in extra genetic diversity and extra individuals, you'll get a big drop in inbreeding for a short time, as long as there's, more genetic material coming in. We see this on the island of Vega, where I did my master's thesis. Every now and then, a moose would swim across from the mainland. It's a fair swim, but moose are reasonable swimmers. And when that moose arrived, there would be about 2-3 years later, there'd be a big drop in the inbreeding factor and in genetic health of the moose, because you've got more genetic material flooding into the population.
Cool.
So on to the monsters themselves.
So first up, we've got the myriapod, which is one of the first real monsters we see in the show beyond the Bruxo novella. So we see this weird tree person, which we're going to touch on later, as the Galeshin. And then, out of fucking nowhere, this gigantic centipede-looking thing with, as Dave put it, a head of a creature from Doom, which I agree with 100%, it's a very accurate description, rips the fucker in half and just comes chasing after them after Geralt yells run. I should have just said fuck. and it's a weird, weird mix of a lot of different features where, realistically, obviously, this thing can't fucking work, but we're going to have some fun with it and try to put together these various pieces to see what we can do with it. Size-wise, maybe it has to, there's some kind of island effect going on where it's coming from an even bigger continent, but that's not quite how that works, but that's what we're going to say is going on here. It has ram horns, much like the Dodge Ram pickup, famous for their horns. They kind of curl off the head, and you usually see those on organisms that where the males will fight for access to females by butting heads with one another. My first week here in Israel, I had the pleasure of seeing the male ibex in butting heads with one another, and it is one of the most insane things I've ever seen in my life. It is so loud, it is so violent, and it is very powerful in its expression. So I really like the idea of these gigantic centipede-looking motherfuckers with doom heads and human arms on their torsos, like rearing up on their many, many centipede legs and just butting heads with one another, trying to fight for their sexy centipede ladies.
Have to have really reinforced skulls.
And a way to...
Which is going to be hard when you've got like that vertebrae like going up an enormous kind of segmented body.
And a way to build up speed. Like that's sort of the main idea with horns, right? If you're butting those against each other, you have to be able to back up and like...
Not necessarily.
Well, maybe they're rearing back and then clashing together like giraffes do with their necks.
Okay.
Well, that's what the ibex do. They will come up on their hind legs and then come down and crash on each other head first.
I've seen it too. So, they use a rock to get even more height to come down as well.
Nice.
Also known as cheating, but it works because physics.
I love Adam. The thought of Adam out with like a high-powered rifle, like just picking off cheaters who are using rocks. Like, that's not fair. You're disqualified, motherfucker.
Not going to be evolving on my watch. Hold action, click. So the idea of these gigantic, what has to be a 5 or maybe even 7 meter long, 20 foot long monster, rearing up on the first, 3/4 of his body, and then just kind of crashing down together in a whole mess of legs, limbs, arms, and horns, fighting for access to females, is really cool. So that's where I'm saying these horns are evolving from. The weird human arms sticking out of his torso is an issue we've run into with the quote, I'm not even going to say it, the big monster from underwater. And the forest god from the ritual, where you can't really stack limbs from other organisms on top of one another. But one thing that we can do with our hands is manipulate objects and manipulate tools in particular. So ourselves and other primates are really good at using our thumbs, you know, to manipulate other objects and to do really cool stuff with them. So I'm not quite sure what tool they'd be using, but this gigantic centipede monster that has horns and is much, much faster than you are can also use tools. So maybe if you are in a car or something, or maybe on a really fast horse, it can construct a bolero and throw it around the legs of your horse and trap you and then come down and eat you because it will then run down.
That thing would be fucking terrifying with a crossbow.
Exactly. Exactly. It wouldn't even need to reload it because it just needs one shot. It's that good. Because it has like 18 eyes on its face, so it can probably see pretty well.
It's got like an extra mouth, like jutting out like places twisted. As well.
Yeah, I think that might speak to some kind of weird conjoined twin or horrendous genetic defect.
Adam, affecting it. I would just like to point out that I feel Libby and I both know why it developed the arm. It clearly evolved it so it could caress Henry Cavill.
100%.
Come to me.
There is an enormous selection pressure there as soon as all these organisms have seen the first scene of The Witcher with Henry Cavill in the bath.
Well, that's what I was supposed to say. They developed the arms to draw the bath for Henry Cavill. And then soap him down and caress him.
Reminds me of those skits you used to see, like Leslie Nielsen, where, you know, he puts his arm up there and the woman puts her arm and then they put the other arms and then other arms just keep popping out from everywhere.
Exactly. So yeah, we're in this case, because okay, everything else goes with this creature, this is a case of Lamarckian evolution, where a creature has seen some kind of thing it wants to respond to. The classic idea being that a giraffe sees a really high plant and just decides, I'm going to make my neck grow longer when I have offspring, because that's how evolution works. It's not a thing. But for this organism, we're going to say it is. And it saw Henry Cavill and his beautiful portrayal of Geralt and said, you know what? I want to draw this man a bath. I need to grow human arms for that. So it did. That's science. I have a doctor.
Charles Darwin would definitely support that sort of thing.
He's not rolling in his grave as we speak, for sure.
Okay, what do we put next?
Fleshy, leshy, eat your fleshy.
Eat your fleshy.
Lesh is more.
Ooh. Mm.
Do you want to fleshen out these ideas?
That was good, actually.
It will be my fleshy-er. Yeah, so much like many of the monsters that that Andrei Sapkowski used in the Witcher series, they're kind of, I think Fleshen is one of these, kind of taken from Slavic folklore. Libby, is that true?
Yeah, I'm going to discuss that later.
Sweet.
Okay, I'm not going to touch on that. From, I can't
you don't want to lessen the impact of Libby's section?
Can we mute him?
The Fleshen, I don't think, is ever really described very much in the book. And in the game, it just looks like a very tall, skeleton-headed, like, deer-antlered creature that is terrifying with its use of magic and strength. This show seems to be this weird tree person who is rooted to the ground, but also has tendrils coming out of the ground. But then, in the series, it seems to have the ability, this mutated version that has appeared in the series, has developed the ability to plant a seed of some kind, maybe some kind of larva, because we think this is an animal, onto the body of Eskel, who is a very weird portrayal of a character from the book and the show, or the game, sorry. And we see this horrendous scene of a tentacle, tendril plant growing out of this weird wound on his shoulder that made me squirm, that I really didn't like. But he then turns into this horrendous bark monster with tentacles, like a weird squid-looking man with a Eskel face, kind of, but bark skin. But this kind of made me think that this weird transformation he goes through after being implanted with some kind of seed seems to be a kind of life cycle that this organism must be going through, because the first time we see it is a human, a hominid-shaped organism with a human-looking head, shoulders, arms, and then a body that just kind of turns into a skirt dress-looking tree trunk, not really any true legs. The Witchers mentioned these creatures can't reproduce, and any of the ones you see have been around since the conjunction, so 1,500 years old.
Yeah.
I think this is maybe one of those cases where the science of the Witchers isn't quite caught up with the true fact of this world. And they do reproduce, but the way they do this is by taking a unwilling control of another organism, in this case a hominid, like the one that made the original Leshen and the one that let the Eskel turn into. And you have a parasite phase where it's growing in him, taking his nutrients, You have a weird mobile phase where he turns into this horrendous tentacle tree monster. It needs to find a suitable habitat with potentially enough nutrients, good sunlight, lack of competitors in the area. Because the Leshy that we see in the show, I think Leshy is plural, the Leshin we see in the show, is kind of in a clearing. There's not really a lot around it. So it's either outcompeted or picked an environment where there weren't a lot of trees in the first place to worry about taking its sunlight. And then it will take root and turn into the version that we see the first time we see it, this weird tree-looking person.
Yeah. Which we, okay. Yeah, and we do see with, there are a variety of aquatic organisms that will root in place and then potentially lock themselves down and start to grow, but may experience more mobile forms sort of earlier in life.
Yeah, mobile and then a sessile form, right?
Yeah, sessile. You have some mollusks, like the mussels. I think their larvae are parasitic and they lodge in fish gills, and then they will eventually come out and form their more sessile or sedentary adult stage somewhere else down the road.
And you get the opposite as well, whereby, so with a lot of jellyfish, they form as polyps, as sessile organisms, and then they will grow into a more mobile phase later on in life.
So. Yeah.
Called the Medusa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm totally on board from a physiology perspective of it's not controlling his mind, it's not taking him over. The parasite is growing in him way too quickly, as we've discussed before, and it would definitely have to be more on the animal than plant side, but it's going to be some sort of weird crossbreed system we potentially just haven't seen before. Now,
it's a weird fungus.
And on that note, bringing in two different stories from the world of biology is cool. So the first one that I wanted to talk about was, generally speaking, plants cannot grow inside of human beings. However, there are cool, fun exceptions. So a number of years ago, a 75-year-old man from Massachusetts, Ron Svedden, had been experiencing shortness of breath for a couple of months. His condition started deteriorating and he found himself coughing incessantly at least once a day. He knew there was something serious. He called 911 and he was rushed to the hospital. Doctors took x-rays of his chest and found that one of his lungs had collapsed and there was a tiny spot seen on x-ray. The doctors were pretty sure that he was experiencing cancer. They ended up taking some biopsies from the site, which turned out not to be cancer. Instead, when they did further imaging, they found out that there was a pea plant growing inside of one of his lungs. So,
horrendous.
As far as they can tell, he must have been eating peas and a pea must have gone down the wrong hole. So basically, he aspirated it. The warm and moist conditions present inside the lung were a good place for the plant to start growing. It was at that early stage where it didn't need light development. So basically, the plant's just using its nutrient resources to grow. After a fairly simple surgery, they removed a 1.25 centimeter pea plant from his lung, and he was sent back home.
So he aspirated it?
Nice. Plants growing inside of humans and other organisms. Fungal organisms are the closest that I can get to something actually rooting and growing within a human organism, or within a dog, or other species that might be affected. So blastomycosis, generally speaking, lives in decomposing organic material found in the United States and within Canada, and can affect both humans and animals if the soil is disturbed and they breathe in the spores, if they're already experiencing some form of immunocompromise. We talk about the fear of black mold and molds and other material growing in the house all the time, and humans are terrified of breathing in these spores. 99.99999% of the time, you will be totally fine. There actually is no convincing evidence whatsoever that breathing in black mold in a home will increase your chances of cancer or abnormal growth development in your lungs. If you've got allergies or you're immunocompromised, it can worsen pre-existing conditions. But everybody's afraid that they're going to get some sort of mold development in their lungs. The only big one that does this more frequently is organisms like blastomycosis. Now, the reason that I bring this up, in humans, if they do get blasto, they've got a weakened immune system. Usually they see fever, cough, night sweats, chills. If the organism moves into their central nervous system or their lungs, they usually have to be treated aggressively with antifungal medications. Guess how long your standard treatment is if you're affected with blastomycosis. You've got a fungal organism growing, let's say, in your lungs.
1 year?
Yeah, 6 months to a year.
Jeez.
Now, in dogs, for reasons we don't fully understand, they are way more susceptible to this. And usually dogs that are affected When the organism starts to grow inside of their lungs, it can oftentimes move into the central nervous system. It can also move into their reproductive organisms, most likely their testicles, and also oftentimes moves into the eyes. Now, when we're trying to treat these organisms, the natural defenses of the body are so high that actually trying to get a drug that penetrates into these tissues to kill the organism while it's growing can sometimes be impossible. So we very often have to euthanize dogs with really bad blasto reactions. Their lungs end up looking very similar to cancer when it takes place. And if it's affected their eyes or their testicles, we usually end up having to remove those tissues. So if they've already been blinded, we'll just simply enucleate. And if they are an intact male dog and it's affected the testicles, we just end up neutering them. Now, treated early, prognosis is usually 50 to 75%. I can't say I've ever seen one of these cases successfully treated because we never catch them early. It will not make them root into the ground. It will not make them grow a series of bark. But this is the closest I can get of some organism moving in and abnormally growing in these tissues, aside from a pea plant just trying to make its day in your lung.
Dumb question. So if, like, you know, this thing moves and grows and it kills you, will it eventually, like, come out? Like, I'm just imagining, like, fungus growing on a decaying corpse. Like, is that what it'll look like if it just keeps growing and growing?
Yep.
That's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, like, it can potentially be shut off from other resources, but it'll continue to consume the tissue.
Wow.
Yeah, we usually don't get to that point because humans, dogs that are affected, they're usually incinerated afterward. But yeah. So if you're immunocompromised, don't disturb organic debris in the United States or Canada.
Hey, kids, want to see a dead body?
The last quick topic that we wanted to sort of have a discussion on was the elves. The elves, different from what Adam and Sam tell me are seen in the books in this series, are not able to reproduce naturally in the show. They talk about that since the conjunction of the spheres, they can hybridize, they can have...
The circles.
The balls. Conjunction of the balls.
The balls.
The conjunction. Oh, boy.
Since the conjunction of the...
Of the globes.
They have not been able to have any full elf born. That they can have half elves, they can breed with humans to produce sort of a crossbreed, but any elves that are attempted to be conceived, either they will not occur, or they find themselves in some sort of situation where the babies that are born are in a series where they're stillborn. Now, my big theory is that two potential events took place after the conjunction. Either one, there's been some sort of release of energy or change or something atmospheric that's causing an alteration and a weakness associated with their DNA, which we'll get into, such that they can't breed because the elves are carrying recessive genes that when they're combined, they just lead to an infertile child. There's been some abnormal development. Two would be there has been something introduced which is just not allowing these creatures to come to terms. Something new has been introduced into the atmosphere, some type of virus or organism or something else that's potentially put them into a situation where they are not able. It would most likely have to be an atmospheric content. But that being said, there are a number of viruses humans worry about this, like gonorrhea and other UTIs, which can trigger infertility. Now, the hybrid fertility and hybrid vigor, as well as hybrid sort of crossbreeding, there's lots of examples, right, Adam and Sam? Like ligers, or is it mules or donkeys?
Tigons.
That are hybrids.
Mules.
Mules. Mules are a hybrid between a horse and a donkey.
And even like a lot of early humans, most Europeans, as we've said a bunch of times before, have a touch of Neanderthal in them as a product of Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis interbreeding when they came in contact.
Hybrids oftentimes have barriers to allowing for them to couple. And I remember going through all these in class and just absolutely giggling. I'm sure the ecologists know these terms, but example, like the mechanical difficulties where they're just in a situation of like the penis will not fit in the vagina. Like they're too different. And they're like, nope, those things like a kid's game where you're trying to put the triangle in the circle and you're like, no.
But David's love.
This won't fit. Or you do get organisms like the mule, which they're all sterile. They may be viable, they may be able to exist, but they are not capable of reproducing going forward.
Well, I mean, you even get situations where an embryo is formed, but it will not, what's the terminology? Come to
term. It won't make it to term.
Not viable.
Yeah.
Yeah, non-viable.
And we've clearly got some element of that taking on in the show. Something has changed or altered since the conjunctions, and as a result, the only way that the elves are able to continue is by hybridizing.
I was going to say, this makes me think from a story perspective that the elves themselves are mules. Like, there was some higher version of the elf in the history.
Yeah. Hybridization is actually a real threat for a lot of species because one species will come in, and while there are some valid hybrids out there that people do want to conserve, like the red wolves, which Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, a product of coyotes and wolves interbreeding, right?
Yes.
Yeah. They have cultural significance to a lot of people, which I think is a fair reason to keep them alive. But for other species, hybridization ruins genetic diversity, so you essentially lose a species because they've hybridized with another species. It's a massive threat to the Iberian lynx because you have outdoor cats. You have outdoor cats who come in and mate with the Iberian lynx. And a lot of the time, the pregnancies won't come to term or they'll be infertile, but you are still removing a potential mating session from that population, which just means that the population goes down. There are a lot of different fish species in Australia, which are very similar to each other, and they have diverged because of historical separation, but they're still very similar to each other. So if all of a sudden one of these fish species gets into another area, hybridization occurs, and you can lose the entire unique genetic nature of one of the species.
And you could also lose an entire hybrid species as well, because it will be maladapted to the environment that it's in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was going to say, to your point about lynxes, Sam, I think, you know, even further that for lynxes, if I'm correct, there's only 4 subspecies in the entire globe. So it's not like we have this fish and you have all these subspecies, which, yeah, of course, that is a problem. But, like, there's not that many to begin with.
Sam and Libby, are you guys saying the problem is there aren't that many lynx in the chain?
Hey!
So proud of you.
What's the chain? You haven't thought this one through.
All right. There were pieces that I was hoping would come together.
It's a food web, Dave, not a food chain. Come on.
But dingoes as well, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Like, for instance, they've hybridized. They were unique genetically for a bit, but now they're starting to hybridize so much with domestic dogs that we don't know if there's any kind of quote-unquote pure genetic DNA for the dingo lying out around there in the wilderness anywhere. In that case, while we're on dingoes, let's quickly talk about this, because, I mean, whether or not the dingo is native is a big talking point in Australia, because it only came in around 5,000 years ago. So we've got 5,000 years that they've been in Australia. A lot of these species have been on the continent, which, you know, the main continent, the Witcher, for only 1,500 years. And on the note of the dingo, what I wanted to do is take a really interesting paper that was published recently by a guy called Peter Banks, who works at the School of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Sydney, and take a really interesting new framework that he proposed for the definition of invasive species. As I say at the start of every show, I was an invasive biologist during my PhD. That's where I'm much more interested in invasive biology than I am in fucking fish, okay?
He lies. He loves fish.
There is a lot more nuance in invasive biology than people think there is. The term invasive has different connotations for different people. For some people, it can talk about ecological effects. For others, it can include social and economic effects. The definition of harm is also a big part of what we term invasive, but harm comes in many different forms. So there's a lot of different definitions. But the one I wanted to look at today and just ask you all about is, like I said, a creation of Peter Banks in a recent paper that he put out. And you can read more about that in an article he wrote called Why Dingoes Should Be Considered Native to Mainland Australia, Even Though Humans Introduced. And this is the framework, okay? So it comes in 3 steps. 1, has it evolved in its new environment? So, open the floor to you lot. Do we think these species have evolved on the circle that they're on at the moment?
It would be within the realm of microevolution, but yes, I would be shocked if these species have not evolved. Not all of them, maybe, but at least some of them would have evolved somewhat in the 1,500 years.
I guess my only concern with the evolution would just be noting that so many of these species are incapable of reproducing, and that they do seem to be existing since the point they were moved over, like the Leshen. If, in fact, this is true, it's been 1,500 years and hasn't evolved, these organisms do have some form of immortality and they just exist until they die or wiped out, then it might explain why the Witchers are so set on their stern, like, no, the Leshen can never do this, or this species can't react this way, or do this, or like, this is the way we've documented, this is the only the way that it can happen, because this is only the way that it's ever happened.
Okay. Well, it could be behavioral evolution as well. So, yeah, adaptations to the local environment through behavior. Yeah. Okay, but let's say yes and move on to the next one. Do deep endemic species, so species that were native to this continent beforehand, recognize and respond to it appropriately?
Yes.
Yes.
Everyone's horrified by these fucking monsters, aka humans.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then let's go through the last one. So it's passed so far. Does it have an exaggerated impact on native species? And in this case, I think we have to say, does it still have an exaggerated impact on native species? Because this is one of the things with the dingoes. Like, a lot of people say that dingoes potentially would have had a negative impact when they arrived in Australia, but they've been here for so long that those negative impacts have already taken hold.
That is a really hard question to answer. I would say normally yes, because it was their effect on humans was so exaggerated that the humans and the mages came up with a weird mutagenic alchemy way to make literal monsters out of humans, aka the Witchers, who are stronger, faster, they live longer, and they have heightened reflexes. They can actually combat these monsters because humans don't stand a fucking chance. But a big through line of some of the stories is that most of these monsters are dying out, and the Witchers themselves are eliminating their own need for as a profession, because they, every monster they kill, it removes a job they can do in the future.
Yep.
So I think that that's a really hard one to answer, because they do have an exaggerated effect, but they seem to also be dying out in a lot of ways. So I think, yes, they still do.
Okay. Well, then, yeah, then they do not qualify as native. Then they qualify, according to this framework, like I said, as invasive. And I think I would agree with that term for these species. It is, though, like a fluctuation that we do see with a lot of species. They will arrive in a certain place. Their population will expand. Things might change, or the surrounding creatures might evolve, whether that's behaviorally or genetically, to cope with them. And then that population can retract after a while. But, I mean, it happens on different timescales. I think this is far too compressed a timescale for it to happen on. But, I mean, you know, it's a fucking fantasy world, so.
That's a great framework, though. I really like that.
Yeah. I'll go and tell the magical monster-killing man that his understanding of biology is incomplete. See how that goes down. Yeah.
Nice scar, shithead.
Firefucker.
So, story section this week. For those that don't know, the Witcherverse is particularly, its monsters are heavily inspired by real Slavic folklore. Not all, though, but a lot of them. So for my section today, I thought we could talk about some of those cute little critters that we encounter and trace them back to their Slavic roots. So the first one that I wanted to talk about was the Leshen. So in the Witcherverse, Leshens are powerful, protective forest spirits. And it, as we see, you know, it looks kind of like an Ent in this season, I would say. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very rooted, a rooted Ent. An Ent that has become happy with its life and has put down roots.
Exactly.
It looks more or Leshen the same thing.
Fuck off.
So in
Dave, just calm the fuck down here. I'm trying to teach you a valuable lesson, okay?
That was good.
So in Slavic mythology, Leshens are kind of that. So they're powerful, protective forest spirits. They're often related to the Slavic god Porowit. But unlike the game's version of the creature, the Leshy, which is what they're called, so it's not plural, it's Leshen is Witcher, Leshy is Slavic mythology, has the appearance of a giant man, but can also assume the likeness of others. So sort of like a changeling, including changing his size, shape. It's sometimes portrayed with horns and surrounded by packs of wolves and bears. And they aren't evil per se. They're kind of more along the lines of a temperamental fairy. Basically, love the forest and you'll probably be okay if you run into one, unless it's bored, then you might die. definitely don't be a woodcutter because it will kill you on the spot.
The trees are speaking to each other.
Gimli, lower your axe.
So the other monster, one of the other monsters I wanted to talk about was the Striga. So a Striga is a human woman transformed into a monster by a curse. She's filled with hatred towards all living beings, devouring them without a second thought. So she only comes out on a full moon. She kind of looks like, if you see images of it, it's a troll woman mixed with a werewolf. They had a baby, and then that baby grew up and just shredded people for a living. So the Slavic version, and I'm not quite sure how to pronounce this, is Strzega. And they differ quite a bit from their from this form. So The word is derived from the Latin word strix, which means owl, and a bird-like creature that feeds on human flesh and blood, according to Roman and Greek mythology. It's unclear how the word Strzyga was adapted by the Polish people, and it thought it might be seated in a little bit of racism. They use it as a term for Balkan people. The term can also mean vampire or upir. After the 18th century, there was a bit of a distinction between a Strzyga and a upir. And the first one was more connected to witchcraft, while the latter was vampires. So they very, very similar to vampires. It's usually sort of like a female demon. They often thought people were born with two hearts and two souls and two sets of teeth. So shocking no one, a fuck ton of people and infants were often accused of being a Strzyga for just being different. So this included, but was not limited to, people who struggled with sleepwalking and babies that were born with teeth, which is a rare phenomenon. I had to look this up because I've never heard of this before. But it's called natal teeth, and it occurs occurs in about 1 out of every 2,000 births.
Wow, it's way more common than I thought.
Yeah. Horrible for breastfeeding.
Yeah. And so one form of protection against a Strzyga is slapping it across the face with one's left hand. So I just want you to visualize.
The left hand, specifically the left hand? Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you have babies being accused of being a Strzyga, and then the cure of slapping it. So who's really the monster?
I'm gonna go and go back over the first season and watch that episode to see if at any point Geralt just slaps it with his right or left hand.
Moving on. So the third one I wanted to talk about was the Kikimora. So the Kikimora or Kikimora is an insectoid monster species that lives underground as well in swamps. Sokowski's pages describes them as spidery shape with dry black skin, that glassy eye with its vertical pupil, the needle-like fangs in the bloody jaws. And in the TV show, you see it's just this huge swamp spider-looking thing. It's really creepy.
This is the very first monster we see, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Kikimoras are actually quite different in Slavic folklore. The traditional explanation for sleep paralysis, Kikimoras are female house spirits that can enter through the keyhole of your bedroom and sit on the chest of the sleeper and try to strangle them. So that's how they explained sleep paralysis, was a Kikimora was just sitting on your chest and trying to kill you. They are female, and shocker, they are the evil counterpart to the good, innocent, and helpful male version called the Domovoy. The Kikimora was usually described as a small, ugly, hunchbacked, thin, and scruffy old woman with a long, pointed nose and disheveled hair, who wears moss or grass for clothes. And sort of what they do is, when the house is in order, the Kikimora behaves and looks after the chickens and the housework. But if your house is not in order, then she whistles, breaks dishes, makes noises, apparently breaks into your bedroom. And she also can
sounds like a bloody mother-in-law, am I right?
bloody
got her.
So she can also come out at night from her living space behind the stove to spin thread. So very different from the show portrayal.
Cool.
I love that one of the things that the Kikimora does is whistle. But I will say, someone incessantly whistling when there's no real need for it or with no real tune is one of the most annoying things on the planet. So I think I would lose my mind.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting too. What's interesting too is they said in the folklore that she often makes noises behind the stove when she's hungry to imitate rats. But then I was thinking, when you hear rats, are you like, oh, time to feed the rats and like give them food? Like, how does that work?
That's one of those times where the folklore doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so
why is she living behind the stove? Like, is that an important?
Because like, rent is expensive, Sam. You take what you can get. All right.
That's why she sits on the sleeper, is because she wants to kick him out of the nice bed.
That is a very aggressive form of squatting, where you're not just squatting in the house; you're literally squatting on top of the person who owns the house.
Exactly.
There are many misconceptions about squatters and their rights. Some landlords tend to think the worst, while others don't know that squatters are protected in some ways.
So the only last point that I wanted to throw kind of into the story section as well, because it makes me laugh my ass off. Nilvian, the cursed man, the one that we run into in the show.
Nivellen.
Christoph Hivju, the unofficial mayor of Trondheim.
Who has grown the hair all over his body and looks like a warthog. And we've talked about this in shows before. Humans can abnormally grow hair. Hirtuism is a thing, and they can grow it in large quantities, and they can abnormally grow horns, not really tusks.
Another thing I actually did like about this season was Christoph Hivju. In the books, they just describe Nivellen as like making stuff appear. And in my mind, it's just like, oh, there's food on the table now. But I love in the show, it's just like, dinner! And it's like, I'm like fucking flying from the ceiling and just smash into the table. It makes me so happy.
And he's just having so much fun with it as well. He's like, check this shit out. Not bad.
And like giving Geralt the fucking shitty food. He's like, you like this, don't you?
Humans love the concept of half-human, half-animal creatures. It's filled literature for a really long period of time. There's been all kinds of medical discussions where they've tried to figure out, like, can humans crossbreed with animals sort of back in the older ages? It does get weird.
I will succeed, Dave. I've had some setbacks.
Documentary, The Island of Dr. Yeah. Moreau. Yeah.
Now, the more interesting part, and this has been discussed around The Witcher before, is the concept of the pig-faced woman of Manchester Square. So legends of the pig-faced woman originated somewhere in Holland, England, France, approximately the 1630s. And basically the story all goes the same way. There's a pregnant noble woman who's approached by a beggar and her children. She dismisses them, making some comparison to the beggar's children as pigs. As a result, the beggar curses the pregnant noble woman and she gives birth to a healthy girl who is totally normal with the exception of she has a pig head for a face. Now, this circulated for a really long time between those different countries. There apparently is a good version of it that exists in England, where the story has a happy end. And Libby's going to roll her eyes, so I'm going to get prepared for this. So the story involves a woman finding a man to love her, and then the man approaches the beggar that has cursed them and asks for the curse to be removed. And the man is given a choice of either he can have her look normal to him, but pig-faced to everybody else, or pig-faced to him and normal to everybody else. And the happy aspect of the story is when the man turns to his wife and asks her what she wants, and the act of asking her what she wants cancels the curse out altogether.
It's surprising for that age.
Right? Now, this story got really weird in the 18th century. So in the late 1814, early 1815, a rumor sort of swept London that a pig-faced woman was living in Marylebone, an intercity area of central London, said to be the daughter of an unspecified noblewoman. She was supposedly young, wealthy, and living in the fashionable Manchester Square. And people started treating this as real. So news organizations started putting out money if you could grab sightings. Various groups started posting about where she was. Rich families would accuse one another of being the family that was harboring the pig-faced woman and had the curse basically placed on them. Medical experts at the time discussed how this deformity could have occurred and ways that it could be treated. And they even had a pseudo-biography that ended up coming out that was allegedly from a female who'd attended on her. A biography of this woman explaining that she was aged around 20, was of Irish descent and from a wealthy family.
Of course she was Irish.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that was the easiest way for them to be like, you know, not real English. This story circulated, and all that I kept thinking about while reading these stories was the modern day equivalent of TMZ. And basically like a group of guys together and they're like, the Manchester woman's been spotted down there. Do we know who she's the daughter of? We're pretty sure that it's Mrs. Brooksta. Oh, that bitch. Do we got photos?
Side note, this made me think of the movie with Christina Ricci called Penelope, which I think might be based on this, where she's born with like a pig snout. She's not a pig head, but it's like she's got pig face features.
Hmm. My name is Penelope, and I was cursed to be born with the nose of a pig.
So, did we feel bad for the monsters?
I think I do in a lot of ways. There's obviously a level of anthropomorphizing that goes on with assigning evil intent to these creatures that are just literally being animals, and humans happen to be in an environment where they're part of the food web and they're going to be predated all the time. But that also means they get killed mercilessly sometimes when they're just trying to be animals living their life. So I do.
I'm half and half, because a lot of the time these are invasive species, and invasive species management does need to be fairly brutal at times, but I don't know, it's not their fault that they've been brought over. I mean, I still feel bad when we have to, you know, shoot an outdoor cat. I don't like that we're killing that cat, but, you know, it's either that or 300 animals that the cat's going to kill, so.
I feel bad for some of these, and I know you two haven't finished the season, but Sam will immediately know what I'm talking about. Of those basilisks at the end are complete dicks. I do not feel bad for those assholes. Fuck them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to say, because I had a note about the basilisks, next time there's a basilisk in anything, I would really prefer it if you made it run how a basilisk in real life, a real life basilisk, runs on water. Just that, you know, arms and legs flying everywhere. I think that would look hilarious. And, you know, take note, movie makers listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
You can have that one for free. I won't claim any royalties later on.
I feel bad for any monster that evolves arms just to draw our main character a bath, and then he's persecuted for it. So the world is a sad, cold place. It would all be a little warmer if we had a bath.
Okay.
Agreed.
Especially with Henry Cavill.
Mm. Yeah.
Would we recommend this season?
I'd recommend the first episode and nothing more.
Really? Not even the one with Christoph Evie?
That is the first episode.
I thought it was the second one.
I think that's
whichever one he's in.
I still liked it. I still love watching Henry Cavill play. There's something about seeing an actor just be absolutely chuffed to the character that he's playing. I still really enjoy the Witcher series.
Yeah, I think I would recommend it just because I think while some things are definitely justifiable and fair criticisms, I think every TV show sort of has its, quote, bad season. And this might be The Witcher's, yeah. And season 3 might be, you know, turn it all around.
Yeah. I kind of agree with Libby. I think this can be really good. And it shows flashes of it, but it's kind of frustrating at this point, but I would still recommend it. I would also say, and Adam, you can chime in as well, because you've read them a lot more extensively than I have. If you like this, absolutely go and read the books. If you don't like this, don't bother with the books, because I don't think the books have anything that the season doesn't. I don't think it does anything better or worse. What do you think, Adam?
I think if you like the first season, definitely check out the books. If you think that this season wasn't that great, I think the books have more to offer. I think it's a more fleshed out world, and the books does a better job, in my opinion, of kind of showing the political intrigue and having a series of stories with, you know, a Witcher who the show is named after. Let's follow the Witcher who's doing the interesting stuff in The Witcher, and not this boring political shit that is really ancillary to the plot and is taking up entire episodes. The Lord of the Rings in Middle Earth is still my favorite fantasy realm, period. But I think that the world of The Witcher is a close second, just because it does such a good job of having a believable and fleshed out world full of monsters and what medieval Europe would look like if that was the case. Like, okay, we live in the world with like all these fairy tales and folklore. Cool. Folklore is fucking horrifying. I mean, going to the woods means you will fucking die. And that is what this world is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I will say for female readers and male readers that respect women, the books can be a little rough at times with the description of women.
Very rough.
Ciri in the first book is an absolute brat.
Like, she's just so, so annoying. And it's in like the TV season. Show. Well, I think she's better in the second season than what she is in the books.
Yeah, I feel like there's another category of, like, men writing women. There's also men who have never been around children writing children. And oh, fucking Michael Jurassic Crichton. Park. Yep, Michael Crichton is one of these men who has, like, clearly never spent any time around a child and has this idea of what children are like, and it is horribly wrong.
Next week, we'll be checking out Vin Diesel's epic masterpiece, Pitch Black, with the bio rounds.
Hell yeah.
Woo!
A movie I've actually never seen in its entirety, so I'm very excited.
It's really? So good. Chronicles
of Riddick in theaters.
I've probably seen it like 10 times. I'm excited.
Yeah. I'm excited.
Yeah.
Oh, this is... Vin Diesel is as much a nerd about his own Pitch Black universe as Henry Cavill is about The Witcher, so I'm very, very excited.
He loves playing Riddick. Yeah.
Yeah, as we say at the end of every episode, the monsters are real. The science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This continent was meant for no one. None of us will have any peace. Gossip, gossip. Until there are no monsters left in the world. Everybody knows.